Are you the Quantum Mechanics?
Yes, we are the Quantum Mechanics, the paranormal podcast for the believers, the doubters, and everybody in between. It was a nice drive over today.
It's nice to drive over in daylight, even though we're recording at roughly the same time. There's still a bit of light out there, which probably makes it less spooky, but it does make it a bit more cheery. Maybe.
It does make it interesting. Cheery. Makes it easier to concentrate on doing the show when you get to the other end.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a difficult week for me, putting me ep together, to be honest with you. You will have had this before, Ben. I got a book, which I thought, this is great. I was going to do an episode on mentalism, so I guess a bit like the one we did on Harry Houdini when he talked about mystics and spiritualists. It's performers who don't necessarily say that they have paranormal powers, but use clever little mind tricks and magician tricks to maybe convince you.
Derren Brown type people.
Yeah, Derren Brown is exactly the type of thing we're talking about. So I was going to do a whole episode on that. When the book came, I started ploughing through it and it was good. It's a classic book. But I realised it didn't have much detail on the history. It literally was telling you how to do these tricks, which was interesting. But I thought a whole episode of that probably wouldn't work. So then I thought, what I'll do is I'll do a bit of a history of it through other research and then see if I could try some of these things on you, Ben. I thought I'd try and convince you I had paranormal powers.
Exciting.
Yes. Unfortunately, I realised it's a lot harder being Derren Brown than you think it is.
Oh, no.
You know, I had this vision in my mind that I could learn how to do at least one or two and you would be sitting there in amazement, but I think you would be sitting there going, well, you just dropped something on the floor there. You know what I mean?
Right, okay.
So I scrapped that, and then I was, early in the week, I was thinking, what am I going to do an episode on? But I might come back to the mentalism thing. I just need more practice and to see if I can conquer it. A week was not enough. But
I mean, a week to become Derren Brown, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'd be a multimillionaire if I managed to pull that off, wouldn't I?
I would think so, yes.
So I started thinking, because you know what it's like, when you do ditch something mid through, you're like, oh God, what am I going to do? And then I remembered that this weekend, your dog and my dog are meeting for the first time for a play day.
They are. They're going to have a puppy play date.
Which is very exciting. And we're, well, I think we're probably more excited than the dogs. They haven't got a clue it's happening, I don't think. But yeah.
I don't know.
You reckon?
Bertie's been sort of drawing pictures of a bear and like keeps asking me when we're leaving. Yeah. No, I mean, he's 7 months old. He was 7 months old last Saturday. And his greatest achievement today was destroying a cardboard box when I wasn't looking.
That dog's got skills.
He has.
Well, in honour of this major event that's coming up for us, I thought, why don't we look into supernatural stories involving dogs?
Nice.
Paranormal pooches, if you like.
Paranormal pooches, yes.
So I have some stories and insights from a couple of great books, one by Lee Brickley, who we featured on the podcast before. He did that really interesting book on paranormal smells.
I thought I recognised the name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he's got a book called Psychic Dogs, Journeys Beyond the Leash. See what he did there.
That's nice.
Yeah, I like it. And then I've also looked at another book by Michael Streeter, which is called Psychic Pets, True Accounts of Animal Paranormal Powers.
Very good. I bet there aren't many hamsters in there.
No, it's funny, these books, though. That last one, I did have a look up on Amazon. Luckily, you can get paperbacks at a reasonable price, but the hardcovers of these books are really expensive, aren't they? I think it was about 60 quid or something for a second-hand one.
Yeah, no, they are. I think it's because they had limited print runs.
Right, so they are rare. But before we get into some spooky tales of paranormal pooches, should we have some random facts about dogs?
Hit me up with random facts.
I say random because I've not really ordered them or thought about ordering them, so I'm just going to throw them out because I picked the ones that I really liked. Now, according to New Scientist, genetic evidence suggests that dogs split from their wolf ancestors between 27,000 and 40,000 years ago, suggesting they'd become domesticated by then. I didn't realise it went back that far, but that's incredible.
As the owner of a Cavalier, I can't quite work out when he would ever have been a wolf. So I find that very believable.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it must have been a long time ago.
Yes.
Is that
yes,
what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
There are lots of theories of why we did domesticate dogs. They range from helping us when we went hunting to one not so nice, that maybe we just had a surplus amount of meat available and we kept some of the dogs as pets instead. And that's how it started.
Oh, that's... Well, that, I mean, that sort of would explain why we have the relationship we do in some ways, in some ways.
You probably know this, Ben, because you're probably more knowledgeable about dogs than me. And I didn't realise this fact until I researched it this week. Dogs have three eyelids.
I do know this because, I don't know if I told you, I had to take Bertie to the vet last week for the first time for an emergency because he scratched his cornea on a stick.
Oh, so his third eye his third eyelid didn't come into play.
No, but it swelled up, his third eyelid swelled up.
Right.
And he's had to be, we've had to give him eye drops all week.
Oh, well, just to clarify the use of these eyelids, the upper and lower eyelid are thin folds of skin that can cover the eye and reflexively blink to protect the eye, spreading tears that keep the eye moist and clear away particles. That sounds a bit like what ours do, right? Pretty similar.
Yeah.
But then you have the one we just talked about, the third eyelid. It's known as the... This is a really hard word to say. It's a nice word. It's known as the nit-tit-tacking membrane. The nit-tit-tacking...
Did you just make that up?
No, it's called the nit-tit-tatting membrane. And it's located in the corner of the eye near the nose, but extends, or I like to think leaps into action, to protect the whole eyeball from scratches when needed, or in Bertie's case, not.
Yes.
But I think it's designed for when dogs are travelling through the brush or long grass or stuff like that, that this other eyelid can come up and protect them from getting scratched, which I never knew. But you found out this week.
I think Bertie's nit-tit-tagging...
Nit-tit-tatting membrane.
Nit-tit-tatting membrane was nit-tit-tacking working. But all that for a terrible pun. But yeah. I mean, I saw it when the vet put anaesthetic into his eyes so we could go in and clean it.
Yeah.
And there was, like, you know what cavalier's eyes, they're quite big compared to the rest of their face. And he went in with a cotton bud. And then as he was talking to us, he left the cotton bud in the eye. It was like sticking out.
No.
Bertie was like, this is fine, no problem at all. And we were like, do you want to take the cotton bud out of our dog's eye? And he was like, oh, I'm just soaking up, you know. There was a reason he was doing it. I was like, blimey.
You're going, have you got a bigger bed so I can lie down?
I know, I was not. Oh,
no,
it was horrible.
I don't like the sound of that. Well, just like human hands, Ben, did you know that dogs have a preferred paw?
I do, because I'm just teaching him to do paw at the moment, and he is a left-handed dog.
I guess some dogs are literally southpaws.
Oh, yeah.
A good way of finding this out, apparently, which hand they go to give you is a good one, but apparently if you throw their favourite toy, whichever paw reaches out first will show you if they're a lefty or a righty.
My last dog was a righty. I think Bertie's a lefty.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have to try that with my dog. Dogs can learn over 100 words and gestures, giving them the rough intelligence of a human two-year-old.
I have read that, and Bertie's got some way to go, I think.
Yeah, but he's a pup.
He is a pup, yeah.
This one I like. In 2003, Dr. Roger Mugford invented a device he called the Wagometer. He claimed it could interpret a dog's exact mood by measuring the wag of its tail.
That's cute.
I did do a little Google to see if I could find a wagometer, but I couldn't. But I love the name.
Did he attach it actually to the tail?
I don't know. I'm not. That's why I was doing a bit of a Google to find an image of it, just to get an idea of how it worked. But I couldn't find one. But I love the name. It sounds like the kind of thing you'd get on a home shopping channel, doesn't it? The wagometer.
It does, from JML.
Another random fact, the breed of Japanese and Pekingese Chin was so revered and worshipped in ancient China that many had their own servants.
Brilliant.
I mean, I know we spoil our dogs, Ben, but that is taking it a bit too far, isn't it? Their own servant.
I mean, there must be some dogs today who have that as well.
In a very short section that I'm calling Dogs and the Law...
Does it warrant its own theme music, or is it so short?
No, probably not. In Ohio State in the US, it is legal for a police officer to bite a dog to keep it quiet.
It's legal?
Legal, yeah. He has a legal right to bite a dog if he wants to keep it quiet.
Okay.
I can't imagine anybody's tried that.
I can't imagine it would work. But...
No. However, in Ventura County in California, dogs are not allowed to have sex without getting a permit first.
I bet they all follow that rule.
Yeah, again, I don't know how the police enforce that one, do you?
No, but this is presumably like an anti-dog abandonment strategy, which I do think makes sense.
But yeah, impossible to enforce.
It is impossible to enforce, but when we got our dog, we found out that actually we can't breed from him without permission. I mean, that's not to say that you couldn't physically do it, but you couldn't put the puppies on the market. Not that I ever would do that. That's not my thing at all.
Yeah.
But I did think that that was good in a way.
Yeah, but not even a little hump, you're not allowed.
Well, I'll tell that to our stuffed monkey in the kitchen.
That is a euphemism I'm not going to get out of my head now.
That poor draft excluder has seen things it never should have seen.
That's why I just got a vision of that snake one with the big eyes and its tongue sticking out with a weird expression on its face.
It's very much like that, but it's a monkey.
Right.
And I don't know that monkey, he's going to have to go into therapy.
Can't unsee that, can it?
You can't unsee that, no. In fact, listeners, you will be pleased to know that I got a new ghost detector the day before yesterday, and I used it to detect whether Bertie was getting too close to the draft excluder.
Too friendly,
yeah. It works a treat for that.
Okay. See, double usage, it's good.
Either that or actually my kitchen's haunted and Bert was nowhere near the draft excluder, but... I hadn't thought about that. I don't think it is.
Or you've got a haunted draft excluder. That's a whole other episode.
He's haunted by his thoughts now.
I've got a bit of folklore for you. I love this legend. The Mabaya Indians of the Gran Checo in South America believed humans first lived underground until they were dug up and brought into the daylight by dogs.
That's cute.
That's cute, though, isn't it?
It is. Presumably they wanted their dinner.
Yeah. Hollywood's first superstar dog, Rin Tin Tin, would sign his own contracts with his paw print.
Aww.
I love that. I'd love to see one of those.
So would I, yeah, definitely.
And finally, in my random facts, one Australian man put forward a unique defence when on trial for drug possession after being caught by a sniffer dog. His defence team claimed the dog sniffing the man's crutch violated his human rights.
Did he win?
Well, the judge initially agreed.
Oh.
Until the prosecution managed to prove that a dog nuzzling your crutch was a friendly gesture.
And that's unbelievably... that's so weird.
What? I'd love to have been in the court for that, wouldn't you? Just to hear that defence going on and then the rebuttal. Fantastic.
That is so weird. I mean, it's all a friendly gesture until your dog does it to... someone that's around your house, and then it's like, leave it, leave it, leave it.
It's almost like the classic comedy sketch. It's all fine until the dog starts sniffing the bishop's crutch when he's come round.
Yes, exactly. Yes. More tea, vicar. Yeah.
Well, shall we get on to some stories I've sniffed out?
Very good. You don't need to be too exact, just rough will do.
Oh, lovely. Now, I've tried to group these together in types of paranormal phenomena. And let's start with some dog behaviour that kind of made me think of Vardigas and Banshees.
Oh, yeah, dogs that know you're coming home.
Many listeners will know one of our most popular episodes, one of our oldest as well, that we did, was about the phenomena of Vardigas and Banshees. Now, Vardiga, you know more about this than me, but I'll do my... interpretation, you can correct me if I'm wrong. A Vardiga is this sense or feeling, and sometimes sound, that your loved one has returned home, but when you check, they're not there, then mysteriously they arrive a few minutes later.
Correct. Yes, yeah, so you would often hear their footsteps, you may even hear their voice, but yes, it's a precursor to their actual arrival.
Right. And I'm sure we all know that banshees are a supernatural entity in Celtic folklore that shriek to foretell the death of a family member, or potential death of a family member, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, both of these abilities seem to be quite common in dogs, Ben, as demonstrated by an English bulldog named Winston.
That's a good name for a bulldog.
Yeah. Now, Winston's talents came to prominence after he was adopted from a local shelter by the Thompson family, who lived in Birmingham. Winston the Bulldog's supernatural powers were noticed by his family after he displayed, I would describe as mild Vardiga-like abilities. I don't know if... I'm not sure whether a Vardiga's a thing or is it the ability?
I think it's the thing. It's like a banshee or a poltergeist. It's the notional entity.
Or energy or something, yeah. Well, whenever a family member was about to pay the Thompsons a visit... Minutes, sometimes hours before their arrival, the dog would position himself by the window, staring at a particular corner. The bulldog only seemed to exhibit this behaviour before such visits.
That's interesting.
It ramps up. Next, the dog started to exhibit banshee-like behaviour. One summer's day, while Mrs. Thompson was in the kitchen, she heard a distressed barking coming from the living room. She rushed through to see Winston staring and wildly barking at a family portrait. A few hours later, James Thompson received a call saying that his mother had been taken seriously ill. The family believe it was the mother's image the dog had been focused on while barking at the picture.
Ooh. I mean, that's sort of disturbing because, yeah, I wouldn't want that. And then suddenly it starts barking randomly at you. And you go, God, am I going to be all right? What's going on?
Wow. Let's see where this story goes.
Oh, no.
Ben. So Winston the dog's strange behaviour continued, and over the time, the family started to piece together patterns in the dog's behaviour. This is amazing. The dog circling around the dining table would indicate that he was aware of an upcoming family gathering. He would sit by the phone and growl before bad news would arrive, or dance around with his favourite toy before good news or something to celebrate was announced.
That's kind of cute.
Yeah. But Winston the Bulldog's finest hour was yet to come. There's a really subtle joke in there that didn't land, was it?
Oh, sorry.
Winston, finest hour? Never explained
yourself. Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
It was...
Oh, Churchill.
Got it.
Sorry.
Hey. So one cold December evening, the dog became focused on James Thompson, just
oh,
as
no.
you were predicting.
No.
He constantly growled and would not break eye contact. Given the track record of the dog and its strange behaviour that night, the family kept a close eye on the father of the house, James. And Ben, it was lucky they did, as in the middle of the night, James suffered a heart ailment. But with the family keeping close eye after they were alerted by the dog, they were able to quickly call for medical help, which ultimately saved James's life.
Okay, that's he's got a positive outcome.
So I guess that's different to a banshee in many ways, because I always get the impression with a banshee sigh, it's a foregone conclusion, whereas this dog's actions sounds like it saved a family member.
He's more medically minded, but perhaps.
Yeah.
Banshees, perhaps less so.
Well, the concept of dogs saving their owners, I mean, there's lots of stories out there of them. And many stories like this one about a beagle called Charlie. Her owner, Sarah, was diagnosed with epilepsy when she was a teenager. And in her early 20s, she still had to deal with unexpected seizures. And on the advice of friends, she decided to get a dog as she believed it might be therapeutic. I guess a good companion as well.
Mm.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Well, this dog proved to be more therapeutic than she ever imagined. After a few months of having the beagle, Sarah sensed one night the signs of a potential seizure. The dog, also sensing her distress, jumped onto her lap, nuzzling in an act of what seemed like trying to calm Sarah down. Whether this was a deliberate act by the dog or not, it calmed Sarah down and the oncoming seizure was abated. There's a nice description of the dog almost nuzzled into her heartbeat, and she felt that the dog's heartbeat was trying to calm her heartbeat. That's how she described it.
That is some empathy.
Well, this behaviour from the dog continued, I guess even intensified, to the extent that the dog would warn Sarah of potential upcoming seizures even before she was aware of them. Alongside giving Sarah affection, the dog would warn her with a persistent barking, nudging or pacing around the room. It would give Sarah enough notice to take medication, alert friends or reach out for medical assistance. The results were amazing, and Sarah's epilepsy became easier to control and her seizures became much rarer.
What a lovely tale.
Yeah. What I really like about this story, Ben, is rather than being deterred by potential ridicule at her story, because it does feel a bit paranormal, right? She put that aside and reached out to a research institute to ask if they would investigate. So Sarah and her dog underwent a number of tests and observations, and it was concluded that Charlie the Beagle's superpower was likely connected to the dog's heightened sense of smell, that they could detect subtle changes in Sarah's biochemistry, and in combination with observing changes in Sarah's behaviour, that's what would make the dog leap into action and try and help its owner.
Gosh, that's, yeah, that is a lovely story.
And since that story's come out, there has been a lot of research on how dogs have the ability to sense illness, and some programs have been introduced to specifically help train dogs to hone that skill. In fact, while I was just going around the internet, I found one in Buckinghamshire near us, Ben. It's called MDD. It's called Medical Detection Dogs, where they train dogs to help detect symptoms of conditions like allergic reactions, diabetes, malaria, cancer, Parkinson's disease, and even COVID.
Wow.
So the dog's heightened sense of smell, I guess they sense chemical changes in their owner and they're trained to alert them that they've sensed a smell of a chemical change.
I hope they wear little white coats.
Yeah, I did see some pictures of them. They're in kind of high-vis jackets for some reason.
I make them feel important.
Yeah. I'm not sure how paranormal the next two are, but I didn't think we could do an episode on dogs without a couple of stories about incredible journeys some lost dogs have undertaken to find their way home. Because I love these stories. I don't know about you. So let's start with the story of a dog named Beethoven, not the one from the movies. This dog was a white Spitz, which I'd not heard of before, but I did do a bit of a Google. Incredibly striking looking dog.
They are very handsome.
So in August of 1998, the Snow White dog, accompanied by its owners, went on a family holiday to Avignon, France. Now, things took a dramatic and sad turn for the family after their beloved dog ran off on the final walk of the holiday.
No.
The family stayed in Avignon, in the south of France, for as long as they could, hoping that Beethoven would return. However, they had to leave for their hometown, which was in the northeast of France, kind of on the border with Germany. So the family mourned their loss of their dog throughout the summer, and their heartbreak didn't ease as winter came and snow fell. However, in March the following year, they were shocked to see Beethoven arrive home. He was looking thin and dishevelled, but was really excited to see them.
Oh, bless him. How on earth did he do that?
Well, the dog has somehow made its way home, doing a 500-mile journey, so that's over 800 kilometres. It's believed the canny canine had walked from the Mediterranean all the way up the border with Germany and had somehow then located the family home again.
That's unbelievable.
So it walked. It spent all that time walking. I thought, Ben, given the journey and the fact it covered four seasons, they should have called it Vivaldi rather than Beethoven. But you know, incredible story, though.
That is lovely. That is really lovely. The thing is, if he'd set off in the wrong direction, I know that's obvious, but I just can't help thinking it could easily... I mean, he could have just got it wrong from the beginning, but, you know.
Well, I read, when I was researching, and I didn't put this one in my facts, because I've observed my dog and I don't think it displays this behaviour. But I read one of the articles I read, it says dogs always wee in a north-south direction, I think it said.
Is that true?
Yeah, well, that's what it said, but my dog doesn't seem to do that. We'll have to start watching what direction a dog is weeing in from now on. Because okay. That should suggest they all wee in the same direction. But it did make me think, if that is true, there may be some level of, you know, like pigeons have got those, you know, they can sense magnetic fields and stuff like that, whether there's something in them in that. But to pinpoint your exact home is really bizarre, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. I mean, it's warming and comforting to know that he really wanted to come home. But at the same time, I feel so sorry for that poor dog.
Yeah.
And that poor family. That must have, I mean, lovely story, though. I mean, presumably they would have sold the film rights.
You would think. Well, no. You know why I don't think they would have sold the film rights? Because the next story I've got makes Beethoven's story and Beethoven look like a bit of a lightweight.
Oh, okay.
So this is the story of a bull terrier with, well, probably the best name for a dog ever. It's called Peter.
Lovely.
Now, this dog was no stranger to travel, and in 1901, he moved with his owner from Britain to Egypt, as his owner was working for the British government. As part of his government work, Peter's owner was stationed in the heart of the country in what was called Upper Egypt at the time, which was up the River Nile. Now, the bull terrier would often accompany his owner on train journeys to Cairo, a journey that could take up to 15 hours. God, that's a hell of a train journey, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like going from here to London on the Chiltern Line. it's about 15 hours,
about
I think.
15 hours. Well, Peter the dog got used to travelling in style on these trips, Ben, as his owner always travelled first class.
Very good.
And after a few months, Peter's owner got a new position, which meant the pair moving closer to Cairo, meaning their trips would now only take 3 hours. One day, Peter's owner received an urgent request to attend an emergency meeting in the capital. Now, given the nature of the meeting, the bull terrier was left behind in their new home. Well, this plucky pet was having none of it, Ben. When he realised he'd been left behind, he escaped and headed to the train station. He found the correct train platform and boarded the express train into the city. So this dog arrives in Cairo and he's like, okay, what do I do now, basically?
Right.
So he made the decision, I guess assuming his owner had gone back to their old home in the country, to head there. The dog once again found the right platform and sat patiently for the train to Upper Egypt. Now the train arrived 3 hours later and this pampered pooch was going to travel in style, Ben. He boarded the train and settled down for the 15-hour journey in first class.
Brilliant.
And the bull terrier left the train at his stop of Upper Egypt and made his way to his previous home that he shared with his owner.
Oh.
When he got there, he realised his owner wasn't there and perhaps annoyed that the house was occupied by new people, he headed back to the station.
No.
Once again, finding the correct platform and train and making the 15-hour return journey to Cairo, once again in first class.
But where's he getting food and water from?
Well, it's first class.
He's got a trolley service.
It'd be trolley service. He can have whatever he wants. He's probably there with a little glass of bubbly as well. He arrives back in Cairo and then is like, what do I do next? If that huge trip wasn't enough, Ben, Peter the bull terrier decides to go and walk around Cairo looking for his owner. But this four-legged traveller didn't aimlessly wander around the city. He visited a number of his owner's friends' houses in search of his human companion. How he managed that, I have no idea. Luckily, one friend recognised the dog, shut him in a room so he could contact the owner. However, Peter the bull terrier wasn't happy about that. Didn't like that idea. So managed to escape, made his way back to Cairo station, once again found the right platform and train to take him back to his new home. On arriving at his new home in Damanhur, Peter waited until a first-class passenger opened the door for him, jumped down onto the platform, and made his way back to his new home. The pooch was now back where he had started 42 hours earlier and was filled with joy when he spotted his owner waiting for him.
Aww.
So this dog's entire journey had taken nearly 2 days, had involved 4 different train journeys and 3 different railway stations, not to mention a tour of Cairo in search of his owner's friends. He'd travelled halfway across Egypt, admittedly in style, right? And then managed to find his way back home.
That is a really lovely story. And the only thing I want to know is how do they know that that's what he did? Because presumably people spotted him and yeah. they know that's how he did it.
Yeah, because I'm sure it would have, you know, what are you going to do? There's a dog on a first-class rail carriage. That would attention. The family who had now moved into their old home saw the dog because it turned up there. And then when it got back to Cairo, it turned up at, you know, at least one of the friends of his owner's houses who'd spotted him and took him inside and said, I'll keep him here. And then he'd obviously got out of that and managed to get home to his new home.
That is an amazing story. Plucky pull, you said it was a pit bull terrier?
It was, yes.
Smart dog.
Really smart dog, yeah. I love the fact, I mean, in a way, Beethoven, the dog in the story before, could have taken a leaf out of that dog's book because, you know, he was first class all the way, wasn't he?
Exactly,
this one?
Yes. Should have got on a train.
Yeah, should have got on a train.
Well, that is, I'm very pleased that, like, dogs are cleverer than we think.
They are indeed. Now, all right, we'll do this. This is the slightly sadder ones, but they're moving and they're really inspiring. So, Ben, we both know that us humans have a strong emotional attachment and loyalty to their dogs. And that attachment and love is also there between the dog and us, right? That's right. Why we love them. Now, sometimes people discount this, say it's just because, you know, our dog depends on us for food, shelter, or, you know, even a walk. But the next two stories I have seem to suggest the bond is stronger than that, especially when it comes to grief. The first story involves a sheepdog called Chubby. Now, Chubby lived with Jim and Mary
good
Wicks.
Name.
Yeah, good name for a dog, isn't it? Chubby lived with Jim and Mary Wicks in Perth in Western Australia. Jim Wicks experienced firsthand how devoted this dog was to him after Jim was badly burnt during a house fire. This is so sweet. During Jim's recovery process, Chubby the sheepdog would not leave his side. He guarded him against danger and affectionately provided companionship throughout Jim's painful recovery process. After Jim had recovered, Chubby went back to his normal pattern of behaviour. He was a real outdoor dog, spent all his time outdoors. So he'd kind of come in while Jim was kind of bedbound and spent all his time in the house. Once Jim had recovered, he went back to his usual routine of going outside. Now, unfortunately, in May of 1993, Jim started to feel ill again. Chubby began barking at the door of the house. When he was let in, he ran to Jim's bedside and refused to move. Unfortunately, the next day, Jim suffered a stroke and fell into a coma and was taken to hospital. And he did not recover, passing away a couple of days later. And although the dog had no logical understanding of what had happened to his beloved owner, straight after Jim's passing, Chubby moved to the veranda of the house and would not move, eat, or barely drink.
Aww.
A week after Jim's passing, Chubby the sheepdog passed away too. There was no logical explanation for the dog's death, and the family believed Chubby had died of a broken heart.
Oh, poor Chubby.
That's such devotion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And it's not the only story of a dog consumed by grief. In fact, the next story just shows how loyal and the depth of emotion a dog can feel towards their human companion. It is a bit of a tearjerker, I'm warning you. It features a greyhound named Rufus, who lived with a retired postman called Douglas McAllister in Glasgow, Scotland. Now, Douglas and his greyhound Rufus can only be described as inseparable, but unfortunately that was about to change. One cold winter morning, Douglas McAllister passed away peacefully in his sleep. A few days later, the family held a funeral in the local cemetery, and among the mourners was the devoted greyhound Rufus. The greyhound quietly watched the ceremony from the sidelines until the service was over. The other mourners started to disperse. At this point, the dog slowly moved forward, approached the grave, and lay down on the freshly turned soil. Family members tried to coax the dog away and bring him home, but Rufus refused to budge. Now, when I say he refused to budge, not just on that day of the funeral, he would not move at all. After a few days, news of this devoted dog spread through the neighbourhood. People would visit Rufus at the graveside on a daily basis, bringing food, water and blankets. Many residents would sit with the dog, stroking and talking to him, trying to coax him away from the graveside, but Rufus refused to move. Ben, this went on for months. Winter turned to spring, but the dog would still not move. And this dog became a kind of weird celebrity in the area. Children would visit the dog, play with him. Some older residents would try and act as what I read as almost like a kind of therapist to the dog, you know, talking to him about their dogs and their pets and trying to kind of persuade the dog to come home with them. But no, nothing would shift Rufus. Months turned into years. Even tourists would come and visit the devoted greyhound. Then one morning, a groundskeeper at the cemetery found Rufus lying on top of Douglas's grave. The dog, like his owner, had passed away in the night. Rufus the greyhound had spent over 4 years at the graveside.
Oh, that reminds me of Greyfriars Bobby.
Ooh, what's that?
It's a very similar story about a dog that did the same thing. There's a statue to him in the hometown, although I think Greyfriars Bobby has been proven there are problems with the story.
Right.
But that one, I've never heard the story outside of Greyfriars Bobby, so that's really interesting. I wonder what was going on there, though. I mean, I don't know, maybe the dog just didn't know what else to do.
You know, how did it know that was its companion that was in that grave? Do you know what I mean? And then not leave. It's, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. Exactly.
Well, the last story I've got today, I have to say, is one of the strangest paranormal stories I've come across. It's about a Labrador with a very unique paranormal ability. The dog in question is called Nero, who lived with the Davison family in Liverpool. Now, the Davison family got Nero when he was a puppy. And as we know, Ben, all puppies can be overexcitable, full of energy, and like to hump a draft exclusive, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we know about that.
But I guess Labradors are kind of famous for that, aren't they? In Labrador puppies especially.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, there's a toilet roll dedicated to that.
Exactly. Well, after a few months of having the puppy, the family noticed something very strange about the pooch. This bit feels like a scene out of a movie. So the family's teenage daughter, Anna, was up late reading a book by the fire. She felt the temperature drop. The lights started to flicker. And she looked down at the dog by her feet and she could not believe her eyes. The dog was glowing.
Glowing?
Glowing. She described the dog as having a soft luminescence outlining the Labrador's silhouette. It lasted for a few seconds and then faded.
How peculiar.
So strange, isn't it? Now, Anna brushed off the incident, as you would, as a kind of trick of the light. It was late, she was tired, you know, it was her imagination getting the better of her. But then other family members started to witness the same strange phenomena from the dog. In one instance, Anna's mother was in the kitchen. She too felt a temperature drop. Then her eyes were drawn to the pantry and there was Nero surrounded by a soft glow.
Oh, he just wanted to be a nightlight.
Yeah. Well, I think the bit with the book, it said I guess the lights had gone out, and she said it was so bright you could read a book by it.
So, do they give any details? Like, was it his fur or was it his body?
No, it was just like a glow that was on the outside surrounding him. And these were not just a couple of random examples. The dog would regularly glow in this way. And it started the father of the family thought he'd log these instances and see if there was any kind of pattern. You know, I guess you must be thinking all kinds of stuff. Are we feeding it something that's making him, you know, has he got his ready break to have a bit of an old throwback? But you must think, you must look for a natural explanation, but it's pretty hard to find one, right? The father realised Nero's glowing coincided with other strange paranormal phenomena in the house. The drop in temperature, we've already mentioned, it's a classic, right? He also heard the sounds of footsteps when he was alone in the house, and the dog would glow at that point as well.
No, what, human footsteps or dog footsteps?
No, human footsteps.
Oh, right, okay.
And there was the smell of roses, you know, no matter what time of year it was, if it was the middle of winter, there'd suddenly be this smell of roses, and yeah, there's the dog in the corner glowing.
That's really weird.
Well, the family decided to do a bit of amateur paranormal investigation, and they started to research the history of the house. They discovered that the house had been built in the early 1800s and been lived in by a sea captain and his wife. The sea captain was tragically lost at sea, leaving his widow heartbroken, and she would place a candle on the windowsill every night, I guess as a sign of love or a beacon to her lost husband's spirit. Now, so the family came up with this theory that the widow's spirit was still present in the house and that their dog's glowing in some way represented the candle that she lit every night. I mean, that might be a little bit of a stretch, but it's reasonably logical.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I think I would struggle to get anything more, you know, think of another reason.
Now, after their research, Nero the Labrador's glowing incidents became less frequent, though a lot of the other paranormal activity remained. The family believed that researching the story had somehow allowed the spirit to live a bit more harmoniously with them in the house. Nero went on to live a long and happy life, but would still occasionally glow right the way up until his passing.
So, I mean, obviously it's bizarre, but what an unusual thing.
That'd be incredible to see. I know we've talked on in the past about wanting to see an animal ghost. It's probably the closest we've got to a description of something like that. Because the implication from their story is, you know, it's somehow this dog tapping into the paranormal activity or the spirit that is still there in the house.
It's a heck of a thing to report to your vet.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's covered by insurance, is it?
No. Wow, that is... And the dog seemed unbothered.
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah. It would glow. A glowing lab. Well, if you like the stories we've heard today, check out the books I mentioned. So Lee Brickley, Psychic Dogs, Journey Beyond the Leash. We mentioned he did that one on paranormal smells as well. He's got a lot of interesting books about all things paranormal, so he's worth checking out. That's Lee Brickley. And the other was by Michael Streeter, and that was called Psychic Pets, True Accounts of Animal Paranormal Powers. That one's not just about dogs. There are other paranormal pets in there as well, cats, other stuff.
Mainly hamsters.
Yeah. I think there is a hamster story.
No, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, okay.
There you go.
Well, thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I'm going to go back and... I tell you, Bertie needs a wash, and he hates having a wash, so...
That's so funny you said that, because we were just saying before you came round, Bear, my dog, is a bit smelly. So we really need to give him a bit of a bath and a bathe, especially if he's got his play date on Sunday. So
yes,
they're both going to be spruced up and then just rolling about in dirt, I guess.
I hope so. That's what I would like them to do. But first of all, because he sleeps in bed with me, he's got to be cleaned up.
Yeah.
He's a dirty pup. But as well as those stories, those were brilliant. Always a different topic every week. And to help us keep up with that momentum, patreon.com/TQMpod. Please go there. Please consider becoming a mechanics assistant. It really helps. As you heard Peter say earlier, the books can be expensive, hard to find. You normally have to end up spending much more money than you imagined. So everything really helps.
And if you go there now, I did put up a couple of photos of our dogs. So if you want to...
Oh, you can see Bertie and Bear,
you can see Bertie and Bear ahead of their play day. Maybe we'll take some on the day and put them up there as well.
Oh, nice. Particularly if they do something paranormal.
Yeah, I hope they get on. Imagine if they hate each other. That'd be a nightmare, wouldn't it?
Imagine if Bertie starts glowing.
Yeah, both of them start glowing. That'd be amazing. Oh, we couldn't... Nobody would believe us if we did a paranormal podcast and we had a couple of paranormal glowing dogs, would they?
And I'd have to... What do they do in Hannah the Baskervilles? They paint it with phosphorescent paint, don't they? Phosphorus paint.
Oh, of course they do, yeah. I hadn't thought about that.
Sherlock yes.
Ooh.
And you know what else is in the Sherlock collection? Connection, I should say. Last week when we recorded Paranormal Gnomes, recorded Gnome Encounters, the first time I heard it... It was on my, the first time I heard it on my actual device, because I always listened to it raw, as it were.
Yeah.
Then it downloads and it woke me up playing at about 3 a.m. So I was listening to myself and you, which always wakes me up. The next one to play was a discussion about Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, that's so bizarre.
And then they started talking about Sherlock Gnomes.
Of course, yes, because there's that connection as well. I get the algorithms would have given you Romeo and Juliet. And we mentioned Romeo and Juliet on the podcast, but I'd forgot that was the one after Romeo and Juliet.
That's
wasn't
right.
It?
Yes.
I've forgotten about that. We will be with you next week for more paranormal weirdness. You got something up your sleeve, Ben?
I have got something up my sleeve. I've been looking at, there's a experiment that happened. It's partly still going on now, using something that isn't quite divination. And it's not quite remote viewing, but they decided to look into all kinds of bizarre phenomena. And one of the phenomena that's been bothering me for years, well, they looked into it, and I'm not sure you're going to like what they found.
Okay.
Put it this way, it might be that we are food. I'll leave you with that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I was going to go and eat something now, but I'm not going to.
No, starve yourself so they don't eat you.
We started off... Are we going to start off as food and end up as pets?
Well, we might also be pets. All of this to come. All of this to come.
All right, we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Take care.
Bye.
The quantum mechanics.